From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a computer glitch may have some driver's license addresses not matching up with voter registration addresses. Will it cause problems come Election Day?
The Secretary of State says don't worry.
A new podcast from Michigan Radio and NPR, Believe, looking at Larry Nassar and the women who survived his sexual assaults.
You guys think these women are amazing now. Listen to what they have been doing and living with these last several years, in some cases 20 years.
And John U. Bacon on the Michigan-Michigan State game and those Lions?
I love Lions fans, but this is Charlie Brown and Lucy and the football. Look, they're 3-3, man. It's a long way from anything.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. People think they know the story of Larry Nassar, the Michigan State University and USA Gymnastics doctor who abused women and girls for more than 20 years. He was a serial predator. But that's not the whole story. Believed, a new podcast from Michigan Radio and NPR, digs into how Nassar got away with this abuse for so long. Coming up in 15 minutes, we bring you part one of Believed. But first, Election Day is 2 weeks from tomorrow, and some may be wondering if they will have any problem voting on that day because of a computer error first noticed by the group Progress Michigan. Our Tracy Samilton is here with us. So what's the allegation here?
So the allegation is that, what we were told in a press release by Progress Michigan is there was a massive, quote, massive error by the Secretary of State. And they attributed this to people with close knowledge of the situation. So it was kind of an alarming kind of press release. And they said that this mistake by the Secretary of State could potentially disenfranchise 100,000 people who went to the polls on Election Day
That's attention gathering.
It was kind of, the details were vague. The voter addresses don't match the driver's license addresses. They said the Secretary of State has known about it for some time, but decided not to tell us until after the deadline for voter registration.
So what do they say could happen then if you're in this group where these addresses don't line up?
Well, They alleged that would mean you'd go to the polls and they wouldn't let you vote.
All right. So what does the Secretary of State's office say?
Okay. So these are the facts according to Secretary of State. So if you move, you have to register your new address, right?
So
you can do that either at a Secretary of State branch office or you can go to your local clerk. So Secretary of State says what happened is people who went to their local clerk, that change of address got messed up by a computer glitch, and it was only registered at the Secretary of State in the Qualified Voter File database and not the driver's license database. So people didn't get their stickers that you put on the driver's license to show that that's your new address.
So a computer glitch, it certainly seems from the Secretary of State, we're not saying this was some,
Not a human. Yeah.
What they're saying.
Yeah.
But certainly there's two very, very different potential outcomes, up to maybe 100,000 turned away versus the Secretary of State saying, what, no one's going to be turned away and no one's going to have a problem voting?
Well, yeah. So here's what they're saying is you're not going to be turned away because the poll workers, when they look at your ID, they're looking at the photo and they're looking at the name and they're matching that to their poll book. They're not supposed to look at that address. So you're not going to be turned away. And in fact, it is true. You can show an Ohio driver's license. And if you've moved to Michigan and you're living there and that's all you have, you can still use that. You can use a military ID if it has a photo on it to vote. So they're saying poll workers are not going to turn you away for this mistake. And since now that they figured it out, you are going to get your little sticker. If you went to your local clerk's office to change your address, you will be getting that sticker very soon.
Now, Progress Michigan says the Secretary of State's office delayed telling people about this problem. Is that a fair claim?
Yeah, that appears to be true. I was told by Fred Woodhams, the spokesman for Secretary of State, that they've known about this for about 2 weeks and decided not to issue a press release because it wasn't going to affect the election. So instead, we hear about it secondhand in the most alarming way from Progress Michigan.
So what is there anything voters need to keep in mind if they are among this group?
The Secretary of State says, don't worry. If you're an absentee voter that this affected, you're fine. You can vote. If you're going to the polls physically, you're fine. You can vote. No one, no how, is going to get turned away because of this mistake.
Michigan Radio's Tracy Samuelton. As always, Tracy, thank you.
Certainly.
And it's time to talk sports as we say hello to Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. And John, that old saying certainly held true at Spartan Stadium, revenge is a dish best served cold. And along with rain, wind, lightning, and that cold temperature, the Wolverines got their revenge win over Michigan State.
Michigan fans are feeling a whole lot better Sunday on, of course, for a simple reason. Give the Spartans credit. They have won 8 out of the last 10. That is the best run of any Michigan State coach ever. That includes Biggie Munn and Duffy Doherty, who won national titles at Michigan State. So, been a bit of a drought for the Wolverines, and that was a bit of water.
Yeah, what does this game mean for Jim Harbaugh?
Everything. It sounds crazy, but if you lose this game, then all the critics, all the storylines come back. You can't win the big ones. Michigan, the whole program, has not won a game against a ranked opponent on the road in 17 tries, and that goes back more than a decade. So that's a long time coming, obviously. It's about three gorillas off your back, basically.
I can imagine. I can just, because that always bubbled up, and you know, you'd even hear comparisons to Brady Hoke.
Which is not favorable.
So for him, that is big.
And once you win that game, hey, they're number 5 in the country right now.
Yes.
On both polls. And so if they win out, they are in the national playoffs. It's not a conversation anybody's having last year, obviously. So.
Yeah. And of course, we all know that Ohio State fell to Purdue on Saturday. You could hear the snickering all over the state of Michigan. But you said very loudly on Twitter, Michigan fans should know it's better for them if Ohio State wins. Explain, please.
Yes, for two reasons. One is that strength of schedule might matter. Michigan's 5th right now. Man, this thing always gets jumbled by the time you get there. It is partly a record and partly a popularity contest based on some science and some subjectivity. So the stronger your opponents are, the better your wins are. So if Ohio State is undefeated before the Michigan game and Michigan beats them, that's worth a whole lot more than if they have one or two losses going into it. Furthermore, psychologically, if you're a Michigan fan, by the way, you are happy to see Michigan State beat Penn State a week before, which, by the way, is one of the best coaching jobs I've seen because they had no business winning that game.
Yes.
So hats off for the Spartans on that one. They're badly injured right now. 8 or 9 starters are out, and their quarterback is banged up. So to pull that game off was incredible. But you knew going in, therefore, that State was not going to be taken lightly, and they're not going to be quite as hungry, frankly. So when I coached high school hockey, I loved to see my opponents win a bunch of games before they played us. And I hated to see them lose because now they come ticked off, and you can't convince teenage boys that they're any good. All that said, I understand that college football fans, in my opinion, are the most passionate of any fans, no matter how much is in their own best interest. To wish for your rival to win, they can't do it.
Sticks right in their throat.
Can't do it.
And that's what you were saying on Twitter. All right, go ahead, folks. Take it away.
Enjoy your schadenfreude.
There you are. All right, let's talk about, I don't know, the drama. How else do we call it? All of the, as my husband put it, extracurricular activities, pre and post game, happening with both players and from both coaches.
True. This game tends to have some of that. It's been Michigan the previous years. It was Michael Hart back in 07 who talked about little brother. Mm-hmm. That's been a quote, been on cork boards for about a decade.
And it got raised again Saturday.
It got raised again Saturday, of course. Michigan drove the stake in 4 years ago. That backfired. Kind of a silly stunt. This was a silly stunt also that also backfired. Mm-hmm. Michigan State always does their walkthrough. They lock arms and they walk down the entire field by themselves. This time they're wearing helmets, which is unusual.
Okay.
They also came out 15 minutes late from their scheduled 9:45. So some Michigan players are on the field by then because now it's their field to warm up. So as they're marching down, they basically bump into some Michigan players, try to grab their headsets, juvenile stuff. Mm. So after that, Devin Bush, Michigan's star linebacker, goes out and starts scratching up the Spartan logo with his cleats, which of course became the viral image on the internet.
First thing I saw when I got off the plane from Ireland was that.
Exactly. So
yeah,
Michigan State was hoping Michigan took the bait, and it did, and in the form of Devin Bush doing that. So there's your motivation. After the game, Jim Harbaugh said he had heard from Dave Abloff, the PR guy, that D'Antonio, the head coach, was 5 feet behind the whole line, smiling about the whole thing. When D'Antoni was asked about this, he called it, that's BS.
Yes, because I believe Harbaugh's comment was, that's Bush League.
Bush League, yes. And then, of course, I don't know who doesn't know this. There are photos and there are videos that, yes, D'Antoni was, in fact, 5 feet behind it and appears to be smirking for what it's worth. It all does not amount to a hill of beans, but this is the drama you get.
And the drama fans want.
And this is what feeds a rivalry.
There you go. So Purdue is coming to Spartan Stadium next Saturday, coming off that big win over Ohio State. So what does D'Antonio need to do to get the Spartans back on track?
He needs to get healthy. Look, he's got half a team right now, honestly. And that they're even competitive against Michigan was somewhat heroic. Despite the amazing stats in Michigan's favor, 4-1 on yards. I mean, this game was in the balance to the very end, in my opinion. Look, Lewerke, their quarterback, is banged up. You got 8 or 9 starters flat out of the lineup. It's going to be very difficult.
Now, over the Lions, 32-21 on the road against Miami. So they're 3-3. Is this where you expected them to be?
No.
See,
look,
yeah.
When they hired Bob Quinn, the GM, from the New England Patriots, a great program, obviously, I thought, okay, smart hire. He hired Matt Patricia, also from the Patriots. I thought, smart hire. But then you saw them in August looking so horrible in the preseason games. They lost 2 of their openers to the lowly Jets and the lowlier 49ers. And I thought, these guys are no better than last year. Then they go 3-1, and they've beaten Aaron Rodgers of the Packers. Mm-hmm. They've beaten Tom Brady of the Patriots. And now you've beaten a pretty good Dolphins team at their place. I'm not quite drinking the Kool-Aid yet, but my eyes are open.
Your eyes are open. And boy, you look at the Lions running game. It's the best since the Barry Sanders era in 1997. What do you want to say about this rookie running back, Kerryon Johnson?
Clearly a great call, and the O-line's doing a better job. So you got to go back 21 years to find as many rushing yards as they got this last weekend. That opens up your passing game. If you can run, they can't cover the pass as well. So you start passing more. This is the only time in Matt Stafford's 9-year career that they've got a decent running game.
So I'm watching social media. Fans are, I think, feeling like this team is coming together under Matt
Patricia. I love Lions fans, but this is Charlie Brown and Lucy and the football. Look, they're 3-3, man. That's a long way from anything. And the whole division right now is 3-3 or 4-2. So you've not broken out yet. But they're playing respectable ball. Keep your hands off the Kool-Aid, but stay faithful.
Michigan Radio Sports commentator, John Hugh Bacon. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
After the break, part one of the podcast, Believed.
Those fears go through your head the whole time. What if I'm not believed?
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Earlier this year, former Michigan State University and USA Gymnastics Dr. Larry Nassar was sentenced to life in prison for sexually abusing girls and young women. When you see the image of him in his prison orange uniform and shackles, it's easy to forget. For decades, he was considered a trusted friend, an ally of these young women, beloved by parents and coaches. In the first episode of our Believed podcast, we're going to show you just how he earned that trust. Believed is a new podcast from Michigan Radio and NPR. It goes beyond the headlines of the Nassar case. Not only an intimate look of how a team of women, a detective, a prosecutor, and an army of survivors won justice, but also an unnerving exploration of how even well-meaning adults can fail to believe. This is a podcast about sexual abuse. There will be difficult subject matter that might be disturbing for some listeners.
The individual all around, and the Americans could lose the team gold.
It's July 23rd, 1996. I'm 11. My little sister and I are jumping on my grandma's slip-covered couches, watching the Olympics. The U.S. women's gymnastics team is kicking. Back in 96, they'd never won team gold. They needed one last thing to win, a really good score on the vault. Carrie Strug is the last to go. She's short, got a pixie haircut, and now she's the only one who can win the team gold. On her first try, Carrie Strug botches the landing, and it's right on her butt.
I don't know the last time Carrie Strug did something like that. This is her event.
I didn't understand the scoring, but I knew falling was really bad.
This is scary.
She is limping. Carrie is hurt.
Her coaches say she's got to get back out there. She's only got one more shot. Carrie walks back to the vault, limps a little, and her eyes are focused.
She knows what to do. She will go when she is ready.
Carrie stretches her arms all the way up, takes a couple of breaths, and then barrels towards the vault like her ankle doesn't even hurt. She sticks the landing beautifully. But as the crowd goes nuts, Carrie falls to her knees, crawls away from the vault.
Carrie Strug is hurt. She is hurt badly.
She winces, holds back tears. Her coaches pick Carrie up, help her walk off the competition floor. And then her score comes in.
We have got to find out if she's a 9-7-1-2. She has done it. Carrie Strug has won the gold medal for the United States team.
The crowd is freaking out. Carrie is not. She's clearly in a lot of pain. On that TV screen, there's a young trainer helping to hold Carrie up. I got her, he says. Pause that. That guy right there, that's Larry Nassar. We didn't know then what we know now, that hundreds of women and girls would come forward to accuse him of sexual abuse. Larry Nassar will go on to become one of the worst serial pedophiles in U.S. sports history. But right now, in this moment, he's a baby-faced, up-and-coming trainer with the Olympic team. This moment will launch his career. He'll be one of the most respected doctors in Olympic gymnastics. And that's where we're going to start this story, with Larry, the good guy. From Michigan Radio and NPR, I'm Lindsay Smith.
And I'm Kate Wells. This is Believed.
You were lucky if you had an injury where you got to go see Larry.
I started seeing Larry Nassar at the age of 8, right here in my hometown of Lansing.
Well, pain, that comes to me, the pain goes away. Like I've been called the body whisperer.
Larry gave us gifts, backpacks, shirts, a water bottle.
I heard words such as, you'll love him. He can fix anyone or anything.
And that's how I've made my reputation, is very in tune to the person's body.
I remember out of the corner of my eye seeing potentially an erection.
Do you ever get aroused during these exams?
Like,
and I was like, okay, so we're gonna have to do that more.
Nobody was protecting us.
I think my parents believed him.
I knew it was always gonna happen.
What if no one believes me? What if everyone thinks I'm lying?
Those fears go through your head the whole time. What if I'm not believed?
What if I'm not believed? In this podcast, we want to show you how this guy got away from parents, police, and powerful institutions for decades. Because once you know that, you will understand how they missed it and how you might have missed it too. I've reported on the Larry Nassar case for the last couple of years, and so much of what you saw on the news was about his horrific crimes. And when you're watching this guy in shackles and an orange jumpsuit, it is really easy to forget why everybody trusted him. So in this first episode, we are going to show you how he earned that trust. This is a training video Nassar put up on YouTube a few years ago.
An activity I like to use as a strength test, as well as a strengthening exercise, is what's called the double leg lower down test. The athlete raises their legs up towards the ceiling, and then the coach...
This guy looks like your typical suburban dad. He is silly, he is friendly, he is good at his job. He is a white guy in a polo shirt with his cell phone holstered to his belt.
Videos like this are why I can't stop thinking about this case. As a mom, when I think about my two sweet little girls, I really hope I would be able to spot someone like Larry Nassar, but I don't know.
And that's the thing, right? You are not stupid. You're an extremely good, vigilant mom. And we all think that we have these really good bullshit detectors. But I listened back to tapes of Larry Nassar before he got caught, and my bullshit detector does not go off. listen to this podcast from a few years ago. It's hosted by Jessica O'Byrne. It's a cult hit. It's called Gymcastic.
The number one gymnastics podcast ever in the history of humankind, bringing you the most fascinating people on the gymternet.
So after that 96 Olympics with Carrie Strug, Nasser goes from being a trainer with the Olympic team to its top doctor. He also becomes a professor of medicine at Michigan State University. Anybody who is anybody in gymnastics knows who this guy is. So if you could get Larry on your gymnastics podcast, that was a get, man.
I'm just going to tell you that I'm totally biased in this interview, completely and totally biased, because I just love Larry Nasser, and I don't know when he sleeps, honestly, but he's great. I'm going to stop going on and on about how awesome he is. Because
on the podcast, Jessica says that watching Larry work is like watching Inspector Gadget. He is always doing a million things at once. But Larry told Jessica he had one very simple motto.
Gymnast first. Gymnast first. Gymnast first. Nothing gets in the way of gymnast first. Gymnast centered, their health, physical and mental. Then comes everyone else. Everything else is secondary.
This attitude made Larry a unicorn. Because in gymnastics, even the best careers are brutal and short. By the time your kid is two, coaches are watching like hawks for something that they can mold. By age six, they know which kids have it and which ones don't. And by the time you're out of college, your body is just done, man. You are Brett Favre doing infomercials. So for those fleeting years in between, no matter how bad you're hurt, you suck it up. But on that podcast, Larry talked about pushing back against screaming coaches and demanding parents.
You have to protect your athletes. You have to let them know that we care. You have to not let them know, but let them feel it. Let them understand it. Let them breathe it. It's there. You know, it's not just a pat on the back. You know what I mean? It has to be sincere.
Larry was the guy who saw you, who protected you. This is how he earned your trust.
And you screw up once with one of those gymnasts, and it'll spread like wildfire. If you do something where you break their train of trust, you're done.
Maybe you noticed we're calling him Larry. That's what most everyone called him. Coaches, patients, their parents. It tells you something about how much they trusted him.
And I want you to be able to separate this guy, Larry, in your mind from the Nasser on the news. Because that guy in court, he doesn't have any power anymore. But when it's one-on-one, when it's Larry, this beloved dude, that's where his power came from. It was always just one-on-one.
Don Homer called him Larry.
Who did I trust to keep his eye on her? Larry. I knew Larry would not let her be hurt.
Don first met Larry in the late 1980s. Up until the very end, she thought of Larry as family. Her three girls were little then, munchkins doing tumbling class for fun. Larry was an athletic trainer working at their gym on top of his work for USA Gymnastics. Don just wanted the girls to burn off some extra energy, especially her oldest, Trine. She was jumping off the back of way too many couches. This is a home video from the early 90s. Trine is wearing the team leotard, long sleeves, red and white stripes. Don would watch from the bleachers with a mix of awe and fear.
And she would just give a little nod, just set her bottom lip, and off she would go.
Don would watch Trine launch her tiny body from the springboard into the air, arms thrusting off the vault.
It was always just amazing to watch, to think that, geez, that's my little girl out there jumping around.
And winning.
Yeah. And winning.
Did you catch that? Trine flashes her mom a smile and says, and winning. Trine loved winning. But in gymnastics, winning means sacrifice. Her mom, Dawn, remembers the coaches hosting a big meeting at the gym.
They said 100% of your children will be injured. 100% whether it's a sprained toe or a broken back. You're going to have everything in between. So we have a trainer that's available for the Great Lakes Gymnastics girls. So my mind, I'm thinking, yes, we're in good shape here. If Trinae gets injured, there's somebody there to help take care of her.
That somebody was Larry Nassar. He'd make you laugh while he iced down your bruises, taped up your shin splints. We talked to Trinae, too. She says he even smuggled in candy in his equipment bag.
He'd walk in with his big old duffel bag, and it always smelled like, why not get a flipping new duffel bag, bro? It's disgusting. But he'd walk in, and he'd have, we'd get, you know, you'd come back, and if you were sad or crying, you'd get a Skittle.
One Skittle. Just one. She likes strawberry the best. And she needed Larry. They all needed Larry. Gymnastics is punishing. Spend enough hours hoisting your body up and over those wooden gymnastics bars. Eventually, the skin on your palms rips right open.
It is extremely painful. You bleed. I mean, it's not your favorite moment, but the only way to get through the rip is to do the bars on the rip.
Trinae's mom, Dawn, remembers big end-of-season gymnastics parties where girls had to hold out their hands, show their rips to get into the party.
They were badges of glory. Glory. That's how gymnastics gets in their head.
Trinae's worst injury happened the summer before sixth grade when she flung right off the upper bar, landed on her face, chin, and neck. She remembers laying still on the mat in a pool of her own blood until an ambulance came. Trinae broke her nose. She was in an arm sling and neck brace. Kids at school thought she'd been in a car accident. And through it all, who was there to help her heal? Larry.
He taped my ankles. He taped my shins. He taped my wrists. He worked on my shoulder. And it works. It actually makes you better. So, you know, I mean, you don't become the Olympic team doctor by taping ankles well. You have to be able to make these girls comfortable enough to compete and to compete well and to win, most likely. So he was like in his own weird, goofy Larry way, like magic.
Larry's was the first face she saw after waking up from an emergency surgery when she was 16. She was so relieved when Larry said, "You're gonna be okay, kid." Trinae and Dawn watched Larry's career take off after the 96 Olympics in Atlanta, the one where he helped Carrie Strug bring home the gold. Larry brought back all kinds of gifts and mementos to give his club girls back home in Michigan. Trinae remembers worrying Larry was getting so famous he might leave her gym. Because the truth is, you could know Larry all your life, like Trinae and Dawn did, and never think of him as anything but the good guy. We're going to come back to Trinae's story in a later episode.
But for now, what you have to know is that Trinae and Dawn were not alone. If your parents couldn't pay Larry Nassar, he would treat you for free. The youngest of five in a devout Catholic family, Larry taught Sunday school. Once, his family says, he ran barefoot across the street in the winter to help a neighbor having a heart attack.
It took decades to expose Larry Nassar, to break the good guy spell. Not that lots of women and girls didn't try.
I remember just feeling embarrassed, like, oh my God, I made this report. It was a mistake, and he's going to be mad at me. My parents are going to be mad at me. The police are going to be mad at me.
How Larry talks his way out of trouble with the police. That's next time on Believed. If you want to know more about this story, head to michiganradio.org/believed. There, you can find out how that podcast host, Jessica O'Byrne, feels about her interview with Larry Nassar now, and why she thinks everybody needs to hear it. This week's show was reported by me, Lindsay Smith, and Kate Wells, produced by Juliette Hindley, with help from Paulette Parker. Edited by Sarah Hewlett with help from Allison McAdam. Engineered and mixed by Bob Scon.
Jennifer Guerra is the show's executive producer. Zoe Clark is our program director. Our theme music is by Paul Brill. Special thanks to Emma Winowicki, Jody Westrick,
Rebecca Williams, Vince Duffy, Amy Tardiff, Len Niehoff, Nisa Khan, Hannah Rubinstein, Lara Molman, and Meg Kramer. And of course, the folks at NPR. Mark Memmott, Ashley Messenger, Camille Smiley, Nigeri Eaton, and Ramtin Arablouei.
You can subscribe to Believed wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes will come out every Monday. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please leave a review. It'll help more people find it. Up next, we talk with the reporters from the Believed podcast.
We've come so far, but I think we both kind of feel like if this came out today, you'd still face the same kind of uphill battle.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. You just heard episode one of Believed, a new podcast from Michigan Radio and NPR. So let's talk about Believed with its hardworking reporters, Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith and Kate Wells. It's always great to have you around and on Stateside. So this story of Larry Nassar, it made headlines, you know, not only in the U.S., as you know, but internationally, particularly the procession of survivors that just blew everybody's mind as we heard them speak at the sentencing hearings. And now he's serving what amounts to a life sentence. So in some ways, it feels like the final chapter of a long, terrible story. So what made you want to dig more deeply? What questions did you want to explore through Believed?
Yeah, so Lindsay and I were both in the court for part of that sentencing. And I think I kept going home. We talk about this a lot, but we wrote this podcast kind of for our husbands. I kept going home and feeling like there was this thing that my husband, Mark, wasn't able to get about this case just by watching what was on the news. Mm-hmm. You know, he could be taken by, like, there's so many. This is so powerful. What an incredible moment. But what I feel like didn't come through was how he was able to get away with it for so long. And honestly, wanting Mark to feel the same unsettledness that I felt, that there were so many times when women described the reports that they made and they weren't believed, as terrible as those failures were, there were moments where I thought, I don't know if I would have done the right thing.
I think it's just super easy for us to, it's only human nature to sort of distance ourselves mm-hmm. from that bad bombing in that foreign country or that horrible thing that happens. It's hard to think about this could happen to me. So that we really wanted to take some time to explore not just the institutional failures, and obviously there were some, right? But
many.
But sort of the individual decisions and how this guy was able to fool, I mean, tons and tons of people for decades.
And as we just heard in episode one, people loved him.
Yeah. Right, right.
I mean,
otherwise he wouldn't have been able to get away with it, right?
It's amazing. The podcast focuses on the women who ultimately brought down Larry Nassar, these women we saw in the sentencing hearings, and many more who didn't speak. So people saw that, and you've talked to them for news reports. We've had them, some of them, these sister survivors here on Stateside. But you've come to know them more deeply working on this. So what do you think Believed is going to show us about these women, about these survivors?
More than anything, we wanted to give these women some context, to give them a platform to be full, complete people, not just themselves, but the people that they're surrounded by, you know, their parents and, you know, were they in gymnastics, not in gymnastics, all of these things, all of these factors that make these women whole people, that helps explain in some cases how he was able to manipulate them or the people around them. And so what I'm hoping by giving, obviously we can't tell every single survivor story. I mean, that would just be endless. But we wanted to give a few key people that I think represent many, many more, the opportunity to really to see them as a full, complete person, to see what motivates them, what drives them, and how they sort of think about what happened to them.
And how they brought him down.
That's true,
because,
right.
Like, you see in the sentencing these incredible, powerful moments, and it's frustrating when you know the years of their lives that they have been living this story of being not believed, right. And when you know the actions that they took that led directly to him being taken down, you want to be like, you guys think these women are amazing now.
Yeah.
Listen to what they have been doing and living with these last several years, in some cases 20 years.
You know, my daughter was a competitive dancer for many years, got hurt. We took her to a sports medicine physician, someone who has treated Olympic athletes. And because you believe that doctor is top notch, and as a parent, you want that for your kid. So I know I have easily put myself in the shoes of those parents and saw my daughter in the faces of these sister survivors. And you're moms. You're both moms. And I'm wondering, did you embrace that fact that you're moms as you worked on this podcast, or did you dial that down?
Oh, we embraced it. Mm-hmm. I couldn't ignore it.
Yeah.
I couldn't. I mean, like I said to start off, I mean, that was in some ways part of the motivating factor to really understand how.
Yeah, I think it has made it also, you've got skin in the game.
Yeah. Believed is coming out of this cultural moment that is actually, we're very different than it was even a year ago when the sexual misconduct allegations against Harvey Weinstein started to really launch the Me Too hashtag. So do you think that moment has impacted how people responded to the Nassar case?
I think absolutely it's a part of that conversation now. But when Rachel Den Hollander came out with her first accusations in September of 2016, and another anonymous Olympian at the time, Jamie Dancer, that was before Harvey Weinstein. He was still running the company. I say, you know, Charlie Rose was still hosting CBS Morning News.
Matt Lauer was on the Today Show.
Yeah, this is before me too. So it really took a lot of courage on their part to come forward. And I don't know if you want to talk about how you would feel if it happened now.
Well, they went through hell. They were put through absolute hell from the moment they came out. And what also gets forgotten in this now is that they weren't believed when they first came out.
Right.
You know, we say a lot, like, Larry Nassar went on to get 3,000 votes for a whole school board. Even after all of these allegations had come out, when women come forward, we don't believe them, and it's really difficult for them. And I don't know how much the women in this case would feel. How much is different now? I wonder a lot if Rachel's story came out today against somebody that we really loved. I bet she'd still have a pretty hard time.
Yeah, that's the frustrating part in some ways, is we've come so far, but I think we both kind of feel like if this came out today, you'd still face the same kind of uphill battles.
And we talk a lot between us about how when they were ultimately believed, like that we so often see this as like this wonderful success story for women, and absolutely it's incredibly powerful, but we talk about exactly what it took. You had to be, like Rachel, the perfect quote-unquote victim. Mm-hmm. You had to, all of these women are, you know, lovely and, you know, have, in Rachel's case, put 16 years worth of a case file together, lost every ounce of privacy that she had, and the national media didn't really follow this case until there were 150 of them. So what does it take to be believed, even if you have everything, you know, going for you?
So we've heard episode one, and subsequent episodes will be coming out on Mondays. I know they've put a lot of your heart and soul into this work, so congratulations on doing this for everybody involved with the story and everyone who's going to learn from Believed. Lindsay Smith, Kate Wells, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And again, you can subscribe to Believed wherever you get your podcast, or go to the website, michiganradio.org/believed, to listen and get episode updates. That line of storms that smacked Metro Detroit Saturday left about 35,000 people without power. Moments like these remind us all just how the light bulb is so central to our lives. 139 years ago this day, October 22, 1879, Thomas Edison had an aha moment in his quest to create the first economically practical incandescent light bulb. But he could not hear the applause of a grateful public. University of Michigan medical historian and PBS contributor Dr. Howard Markell is here with this story. So just what happened this day in 1879?
Well, you know, he had been working on the incandescent light bulb for months, but he found the proper filament. It was a carbonized filament that lasted 13 and a half hours before blowing out.
Which in that era was unbelievable.
It was huge because all you had was candles or whale oil. The Dark Ages didn't end with the Dark Ages. They didn't end until 1879 on this very day.
And then I know he applied for a patent November 4th, which was granted the following January. That was pretty quick. But so that's arguably the most famous of his 1,093 patents. What made this light bulb really more promising and more affordable to the public?
Well, not only did he have, later on he worked on carbonized bamboo that would last for over 1,000 hours, but it was the filament, it was getting a better vacuum in the bulb, which required a lot without breaking the glass bulb, and lowering the resistance, and then developing electric stations, these dynamo-powered electric stations that would get power to people's homes in a cheap, affordable way that he, too, could make money on it.
So it all worked. And, of course, we all know we can go to Greenfield Village at the Henry Ford and see the workshop and see the boarding house that he lit up.
The Menlo Park Lab, which Ford supposedly took apart piece by piece. And that has always been my favorite part of Greenfield Village. And I'm a Thomas Edison buff from way back when.
Yet Edison could not hear the public saying thank you because?
He was deaf. He had bilateral deafness, and he was deaf from the age of 12 on, but it got progressively worse as he got older.
So even as he was a boy growing up in Port Huron, he was feeling this.
Yes. So he grew up in Port Huron, and he was a news butcher on the old Grand Trunk Railway line between Port Huron and Detroit. These were boys who sold newspapers and candy and sandwiches to the passengers. And there are a couple legends of how Thomas Edison became deaf. And gosh, I remember reading a biography in 1966, and it still is in my head. One story was that he was running after the train with an armful of newspapers and such, and got onto the steps of the train, but it was moving, and the conductor lifted him up by his ears to get onto the train. And he felt something snap. And ever since that point, he became more and more deaf. Another version he told was that he had a lab in one of the boxcars, and something blew up, and the conductor threw him and his lab off the train, and he fell onto his ears.
Is there truth to these stories?
No,
or is this fancy?
Edison told these stories again and again and again because he was wonderful at self-promotion. Mm-hmm. He was not only a great inventor, he was great at inventing the legend of Thomas Edison. But he later admitted that neither story happened.
So, and you say there's quite a medical debate over really what caused
it. You know, everyone wants, because he was one of the most famous deaf people. Mm-hmm. Now, he always talked about his deafness as a great gift because it allowed him to concentrate. But different people disagree, and it sounds to me, as well as to many others, that he had a series of ear infections. We know he had mastoiditis. That's the bone right underneath the ear, and that became infected, and it's very close to the brain, so you worry about that in terms of encephalitis or meningitis. But he had a series of infections, including scarlet fever, that probably led to his bilateral hearing deficit.
Well, I know that you're a pediatrician. I have got to imagine one of the main reasons kids are brought to the pediatrician would be middle ear infections.
Gosh, it was 99% of my business, and I'm probably underestimating it.
Yeah. So where are we today versus when Edison was young and getting ear infections?
Well, the good thing today compared to then is that you can prescribe antibiotics, and that'll take care of bacterial infections. What we're finding is an awful lot, perhaps most of ear infections in children, are viral. And so you don't need antibiotics, and it may be a problem to prescribe so many antibiotics because it creates antibiotic resistance. So we're a lot more careful. I mean, I had a trigger finger back in the 80s. Everybody got a script for antibiotics.
Amoxicillin. My son had them, so right, we had the pink bubble gum.
Exactly.
And then if that didn't work, we went to Augmentin, which was the banana-flavored.
Right. But Augmentin, which was just had an extra little ingredient, caused an incredible amount of diarrhea. And I remember prescribing that, and I said to the mother, this will cause diarrhea. And she said, okay, I'm willing to do that. She comes back the next week and said, my kid had so much diarrhea. And I said, I know, I told you that. And she said, but you didn't tell me how much. It's a little far off a field from Thomas Edison. But
well, when you stop and think, are there more today than in the day, or are we just able?
Oh, I don't think so. The anatomy of a child's eustachian tube, the tube between the ear and the mouth, is very floppy. It's like an old paper straw, and it becomes flat very easily, and that leads to a backup of fluid and sends a kid to the doctor's office with an ear infection. And they're very, very painful, to children's credit. They're crying for a reason. But I think we've overprescribed, and we're doing a better job now than we did before.
Well, certainly we can take some lessons away about Thomas Edison's deafness and middle ear infections. His attitude was tremendous about that, gave him the solitude he wanted to think.
Well, yes, and he went to the Detroit Public Library a lot, and he said he read the entire library. Mm-hmm. And that's probably true. He was a self-taught man. He did not have a lot of formal education. He did take some classes at the Cooper Union in New York City. But he was one of these self-taught polymath geniuses.
The 139th anniversary of the first successful test of Thomas Edison's incandescent light bulb, glowing on this day in 1879 for 13 and a half hours. University of Michigan medical historian, Dr. Howard Markell, as always, thank you.
Thank you.
This year's midterm election is gearing up to be quite contentious. To better understand issues that are most important to Michigan voters, we've dispatched reporters and producers throughout the state to ask people two questions. What are the most important issues for you as a Michigan voter? And what concerns you most about our political climate right now? From now until the election, we'll bring you their answers in a segment we call Voter Voices. We begin with Paul Jackson, a community organizer from Detroit.
As a Michigan voter, what's most important to me is the liberation of black and brown communities from white terrorism. At every level, at the state level, at the municipal level, at the county level, whether it's the ecological crisis that's been caused by greed and kleptocracy and corporatism in Flint and Detroit in the school system right now, or it's the building of a prison at 94 and 75, or a jail in a place where they're saying they don't have money to buy books and to get school buildings up to code. My concerns about the American political landscape today are having to do with the way in which white terrorism is being more and more entrenched in every level of government and in society and civil society, in the normalized assumptions of media, the things that go unquestioned that are appalling, that are galling, the disregard for what people say is a rule of law, but is really just a charade that's meant to preserve an age-old system of settler colonialism and the domination of black and brown people.
My name is Aaron Link. I live in Farmington Hills, and I'm an engineer. You know, for me, the thing I see is the resurgence of Detroit, and so anything that can hinder or help that is probably the most important thing to me, and certainly the helping of it. I kind of wish social media would take a back seat. You know, sometimes it seems like it's not productive. It's a lot of bickering and back and forth and kind of not moving things forward in a positive way. I think there's a lot of good things going on in the country, right, compared to 10 years ago, where the recession and, you know, the big three up here and the struggles we went through, there's a lot of positive things to take away. And I think there's so much focus on the negative every day, it gets old.
Special thanks to Rozzy Joffrey for recording these interviews. To Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Rusty Brock. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstrom. Contributors are Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, April Van Buren, Sam Corey, Sarah Leeson, and Bella Isaacs. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.